This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You thought it was done, right? All this tax stuff, or at least you get a break from it? Well, apologies in advance, but no. Also, are those Air Jordans you're wearing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, December the 4th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Your reward, by the way, for sticking with us through these many weeks of coverage of the GOP's tax plans is a little bit more coverage of the GOP's tax plans. There is plenty of news out there, yes, but this one is ours, and we are going to run with it. The House and Senate are set to go to conference committee to hash out the differences in their respective bills, so we are going to spend some time this week explaining what those differences are. Individual taxes today, corporate taxes tomorrow, but we are going to start with the four-letter word in this thing, debt. $1 trillion of fresh debt is what the Senate bill is going to add over the next decade. That's according to the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation, Congress's own. And it's after taking into account the small boost to economic growth the tax cuts might add. Yes, $1 trillion is a lot to get your mind around. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what exactly that debt might mean for the economy and why it is so hard to get people to care about it.
Before the tax bill, the U.S. was already on track to add another $10 trillion to the national debt over the next decade.
And I've heard some people make the argument of, well, who cares? We're already borrowing $10 trillion. What's another $1 trillion?
That's Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
I can promise you that is a very dangerous line of thinking.
McGinnis says the national debt is like a huge weight around the neck of the economy. Michael Peterson is president of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, which advocates for lower deficits. He says paying the interest on that debt crowds out other spending on education, infrastructure, research and development, and gives the government less flexibility in the future.
So if we have another financial crisis, like we did in 2008, we might not have the ability to respond so aggressively next time if our debt levels are so high.
So why aren't people more worried about this? John Tamney is director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks. He says there's no sign that creditors won't keep financing our debt.
Let's be clear that investors around the world line up to buy up U.S. treasuries.
In a recent Gallup poll, only 2% of Americans said the national debt was their top concern. McGinnis says it's a little like getting people to act on climate change.
When the answer is you have to do something that's hard today to avoid much worse things happening tomorrow,
people tend to focus on today more than the future. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right. So with that as prologue, some of the differences now in the individual tax code that the House and Senate are going to have to sort out. First among them, tax brackets, arguably the key to the simplification that the GOP has promised with these plans. The House bill has 4 brackets. That is down from the current 7 with lower tax rates. The Senate sticks with 7 brackets with slightly lower rates for them. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra looked into how this compromise might work out.
4 brackets, 7 brackets. Which is better for taxpayers? Depends how much money you make. For instance, the top tax rate of 38.5% in the Senate bill is lower than the 39.6% rate in the House bill. Tom Wheelwright is a tax advisor at the CPA firm Provision.
Obviously, for a high income earner, the Senate bill's better. It's a lower tax rate. It's really going to depend on where you fall in the brackets as to whether it's better for you or worse for you.
And thing is, you have to consider any changes to the tax bracket system in the context of the bills as a whole. Lindsay Kashgarian from the National Priorities Project says the bills treat a lot of things differently. Child tax credits, student tuition, mortgage interest.
So there are so many other pieces involved that the brackets alone, they're definitely a big part of it, but they're not showing the true picture of what will happen to people, especially at the bottom.
Those are people who rely on the tax credits or deductions that are likely to change under these bills. Bill Smith from the accounting firm CBIZ MHM doesn't think the number of tax brackets will be one of the big fights.
I think the fights will be held on other provisions. I don't think anybody's going to care particularly whether it's 3 or 7 brackets or whatever the numbers turn out to be.
Smith says the two houses of Congress will probably meet in the middle. 5 brackets, anyone? I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, the best lesson ever in consult your own financial advisor. People will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to take a break from our planned tax policy coverage today. And yes, I know it's only been going a couple of minutes, but remember, we're talking about the changes to individual taxes that are coming once the House and Senate get their acts together. We're going to turn now to small business. Small business in the form of Golding Barge Lines out of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and the proprietor, Austin Golding, with whom we chat every now and then. Austin, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai, thanks for having me back.
Called you actually to talk about the tax bill, about how you're feeling about this economy and some of the things that are going on with it. First of all, have you been following the tax debate as it's been happening?
I've been trying to. It seems like every time there's a discussion about it, there's a different provision or a different nuance to it. But we've definitely been trying to make sure that we're postured to be in the right position to absorb any changes.
So what are you looking for? As a guy who runs a small business in this economy, what are you looking for out of this tax bill?
So, you know, as a small business owner, pretty much we're looking for an expansion of our operating expenditure capital. 30% of the revenue we generate is spent right directly back out the door into payroll. Mm-hmm. So we have a cash churn through our business as a small business, as a blue-collar industrialized business. The quality of what we do and the scope of what we do is only relative to the amount of capital we have at our hands. So I know people can roll their eyes at trickle-down economics from time to time, and I think there's room to roll your eyes in a certain regard. But with us, with being so capital-intensive, any tax relief we could get would directly result in more opportunity for us to expand our payroll or expand our operation.
In all the years we've been talking, I don't think I've ever asked you this. How many people you have working for you at Golding Barge Lines?
We have 230 people on any given day, depending on which deckhands walked off which day.
And if you get more operating capital, as you say, more money in your pocket, you're going to hire more people.
Hire more people, and I think it'll allow us to give our people a raise in their income and the job they already have.
Let me ask you then about maybe the key thing that might put some money in your pocket, depending on how you do your taxes. This idea of pass-through corporations and a lower tax rate on that, depending on what the bill finally looks like.
Yeah, and I think the House bill appears to be more of a reduction of the direct tax. The Senate bill seems to more focus on the deductions of what you're being taxed on. Mm-hmm. But they're full of limitations. They're full of limitations as to how much money the owner of the company pulls directly from, and there's limitations as far as the amount of deductions or the amount of reductions depending on how your company is structured. Now, if I just had an interest that in a company that I'm managing, I can't tell you that allowing me to have a larger income directly creates more jobs.
Yeah.
But as a small business owner, and these decisions at my fingertips, I will pull the trigger more if I have more operating capital
right.
to use.
It sounds a little bit like while you're pleased, you're not pleased enough. You're not as happy as you want to be.
Well, we certainly are very focused on how it affects our business directly with the taxes we pay. But you got to remember, Kai, a towboat captain this day and age makes $130,000 to $160,000 a year. Hmm. My tankermen make around $70,000 to $80,000 a year. My deckhands make $20,000 to $40,000 a year. So literally my employees encapsulate the entire strata of who this bill's targeted at as far as middle class and what you define as middle class. So when I talk to my employees, I definitely want to know that they're being included in this also because they ultimately are buying the products I'm moving.
Austin Golding at Golding Barge Lines in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Austin, thanks, man.
Thank you so much, Scott.
It can be really hard for people in this economy to get out of poverty. A whole bunch of reasons for that, as we've been reporting over the years. The same thing is generally true, but in a different kind of way, for a lot of the neighborhoods that people on the low end of the income spectrum live in. Those neighborhoods often don't get the investments that are needed to attract new people to live there and new jobs for those people to have. Community development groups, nonprofits that build and finance affordable housing, have been trying to do something about it for decades without a whole lot of luck. Until now, maybe. From Boston, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
68-year-olds Terry England and her husband Joseph have lived in Chelsea for more than four decades. The location drew them in. Close enough for the working couple to get to and from their jobs, right across the harbor from Boston. But for years, their neighborhood, about eight square blocks, stood out for all the wrong reasons. Abandoned cinder block ramshackle factories at the bottom of the hill, overcrowded multifamily homes at the top. In the middle, a garbage dump.
People would go by in their cars and throw whatever, anything.
An illegal garbage dump in this working poor neighborhood. But in 2006, things began to change. Developers built affordable apartments. In 2010, they converted a historic factory into market-rate lofts that back then went for about $1,400 and today run nearly $1,800. The area even got named the Box District. But the neighborhood still was stuck, says Maggie Superchurch from the Conservation Law Foundation. Improved, but to people outside, still rough around the edges.
It's really not enough to move the market to the point where investment is available and conventionally used, and where the perception is that this place is like any other place.
This is a problem that has stumped community developers for decades. But two local nonprofits think they've hit on something. They've created a private equity fund.
We're trying to foster and promote that you can make a reasonable return and have a positive impact in these neighborhoods.
That's Joe Flatley, who runs the Massachusetts Housing Investment Corporation. Since 2013, his group, working with the Conservation Law Foundation, has raised $22 million from investors like philanthropists, socially minded banks, and a hospital, the Boston Medical Center, for residential and commercial projects around Boston. Their secret? Minimize risk. The Healthy Neighborhood Equity Fund takes money from philanthropists, people less concerned about profit, and bundles that with money from the other investors. If the fund underperforms, philanthropists take the hit first, making the investment less risky for everybody else. But still, it's a gamble, says Flatley, so they pick their spots carefully.
Places that you can walk, where you're accessible to transit, where there's places to shop for food.
And because the fund's goal is to create stable mixed-income communities, they look for affordable housing that's well-run and has buy-in from current residents. That describes the Box District. In 2015, the fund invested in the construction of an apartment building with 96 units, most of them market rate.
We love it here.
20-somethings Flavia Wilson Jansen and her husband, both working professionals, recently moved from Minneapolis into a one-bedroom here. That costs about $16.50 a month.
I can walk down the street with my dog and go to the park, and there's kids everywhere. You know, like, it does feel like more of like a community.
The fund has taken another step to draw in private capital to these neighborhoods. It's focusing on health, not the doctor and healthcare clinic kind. Dr. Megan Sandel, one of the investors with the Boston Medical Center, says a more expansive definition.
You can walk at night safely, that you can be able to afford the food in your neighborhood, that you can potentially have a job or be near a job. Those are things that aren't typically thought of as health, and yet we know they are the keys to being healthy.
The fund plans to issue report cards after 5 and 10 years, tracking whether rates of chronic disease and mental health have improved with the investment. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Before we do today's numbers, here's a tip for you. For as little as $5 a month, please consider signing up as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. You might not know that we're a nonprofit news organization, one that's on a mission to increase economic intelligence all across this country. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll do more of it and reach more people as well. You can donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Coming up,
they see hundreds upon hundreds of shoes every single day.
It's a thing, apparently. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 58 points today, 0.2%, closed at 24,290. The NASDAQ down 72 points, 1%, 67.75. S&P 500 off 2 points, about a 0.1%, 26.39. Deal of the day today, healthcare. Major shakeup with the announcement this weekend. The drugstore chain CVS is buying the health insurance company Aetna for $69 billion. CVS shares down 4.5% today. Aetna off 1.4%. Comcast up 4.9% today. Verizon up 0.9%. AT&T up 2.1%. In finance, JP Morgan Chase up 2%. Bank of America up 3.4%. Citigroup lifted 2.1% or so. Bond prices, well, thanks for asking. They fell. The yield on the 10, I know you didn't ask. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Okay, so back to the tax code we go, and the differences in the individual tax code the House and Senate are going to have to reconcile. Stop number two on our tour is the alternative minimum tax, the idea that there should be some minimum tax so the wealthy can't deduct or exempt their way out of paying anything. Doing away with the AMT, as it's known, was part of the Republicans' push to simplify the tax code until the Senate added a version of it back into their plan Friday afternoon, shortly before that wee small hours vote that they took. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
The idea of an alternative minimum tax was put in place by Congress back in the late 1960s after it learned 155 Americans making over $200,000 a year paid no federal income tax at all. A minimum tax rate was a simple idea. In reality,
the AMT has been one of the more vexing problems of the individual tax system for some time.
John Gimigliano with KPMG.
Maintaining two separate tax systems in parallel means that taxpayers generally have to calculate their taxes twice.
What they'd normally pay, what they'd pay under the AMT, and then they take whatever's higher. Who pays the AMT is also complicated, says Kathy Koch with Ernst & Young.
There's always an example of someone who you know wasn't intended to be hit, who's hit.
A very small percentage of AMT payers make between $75,000 and $100,000 a year. The lion's share, about two-thirds, make between $200,000 and $500,000 a year. Only about 2.5% of AMT payers make more than $1 million a year.
You could describe this as hitting far less of the very rich than of that upper middle income band.
Problem is, the Joint Committee on Taxation estimated that eliminating the individual AMT would cost $770 billion over a decade. Kimberly Burham is with the Penn Wharton budget model.
It's a huge revenue raiser to keep it, a huge revenue loser to eliminate it.
She said if Congress can come up with other ways to pay for its tax cuts, Republicans in both houses would like to see it go. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Come we now to House and Senate difference number three, something called the Child Tax Credit. Right now, it's $1,000 per child available to working parents with taxable income. There are some restrictions, also some disagreements about how much it ought to be. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
The House would raise the Child Tax Credit by $600 to $1,600 per kid, the Senate to $2,000. Aparna Matter at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says Republicans want to boost this credit to offset other tax changes that could hurt middle-class families financially, like eliminating personal exemptions, state and local tax deductions.
We are talking about an expansion in the amount of money going to these families.
But it wouldn't go to all families equally, says Amy Mitsui at the National Women's Law Center.
The tax credit increase, as it's written in these tax bills, is much more targeted to help upper-income families.
And to explain this, we have to get into something called a refundable tax credit. It gives you money back on what you owe or adds to your refund tax time. Now, the child tax credit is only partially refundable, Matter explains.
A lot of lower-income families that are not actually paying income taxes don't get a huge benefit.
And she says neither Republican tax bill would change that. Chuck Marr at the Progressive Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says take a single mom with two kids working full-time for minimum wage. Compared to today,
the Senate bill would give her and her children just $75, and the House would actually shut her out completely.
But a family earning $150,000 would get the full refund, substantially more than they'd get today. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We had a guy come into the studio the other day. Eddie Liu is his name. He's one of the founders and the CEO of a company called GOAT, G-O-A-T, Greatest of All Time, in case you're not familiar with that particular acronym. They do sneakers, not just your everyday kicks, though, but hard to get high price point, like thousands of dollars price point, sneakers for which the market is apparently booming. And because the market is booming, there's a fraud problem, which is where Eddie Liu and GOAT come in.
We're an online sneaker marketplace, but we started in 2015 really to solve the issue of fakes. I mean, Nike is the most counterfeit brand in the world.
Okay, so first of all, people are going to the effort of faking Nike sneakers.
Exactly, because, you know, sneakers, coveted ones, go for hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands of dollars.
Tens of thousands of dollars?
Exactly.
How do you authenticate it? Do you have, I can't believe I'm saying this, sneaker experts on staff?
Yeah, so we have a couple dozen sneaker authenticators, and they're basically the heart and soul of our operation. I mean, they are so passionate about sneakers. They see hundreds upon hundreds of shoes every single day. And so, you know, just by sight, touch, smell, they can see, oh, something looks fishy, something smells fishy. Let me look for more into it. And with that, you know, they're the experts, and they really identify sneakers. On top of that.
Well, so I'll tell you what. So you've got two shoe boxes here.
Exactly.
And this is the show and tell portion of the interview. Let's get the headphones and the keyboards out of the way. Grab those. Tell me what I'm looking at and how you know whether they're fake or real.
So this is the Yeezy Boost 350, which is Kanye's line with Adidas that I mentioned earlier. So we have two different pairs, a real pair and a fake pair. And so I'm just going to start even with the box, not even looking at the shoe yet.
Yeah.
But you can tell that even this is the fake pair. Even the
box. No. Don't tell me.
Oh, sorry. All right.
All right. So honestly, you can tell, but I can't. All right. So wait a minute. So what's the price point on these things out in retail market?
Retail-wise, it's about $220, but resale on our app, it's about $400 to $500.
All right, so we're talking of a $400 to $500 pair of sneakers. I guess the boxes are a little bit different, right? The real box is sturdier and better looking. But, you know, that you have to sit here and look at it for a minute. I mean, how do you know?
You definitely do, and this is why our authenticators are so important. So if you look at this box, it's clearly smaller and shorter than the real box, which is important. And that's before we even get to the shoe itself.
I totally see that, but again, only because you're pointing it out. All right, let's open these boxes and figure out what's what. You take the fake one, I'll take the real one. Or at least I believe they're real, only because you tell me. I don't know. I can't even open this box, man.
It'll be right here.
Of course it will. He's like, no, don't rip the box. That's a $400 pair of shoes. I don't want to mess him up. If I mix them up, are you going to be able to tell which is which?
I will be able to tell.
All right, okay.
Yes.
All right, so first of all, these are not great looking shoes, but that's just a subjective thing. I don't know. So the box thing I noticed because you pointed it out, and I'm looking, I know which one's real and I know which one is fake.
So we picked a very good pair of fakes. This is one of the best fakes.
So you can't blame me for not being able to tell. All right. Yeah. I mean, honestly, if I were just looking, I would not be able to tell, truly.
All right. So
what are you looking at?
So as you can see, let me just make sure.
Yeah. Now you're just making sure.
So the stripe on the real one actually extends further than the fake pair right here.
Yeah.
And then if you look down here, this kind of striping is a lot higher on the fake pair.
Than, and that's a mark of authenticity or fakeness?
Fakeness.
I guess if you're spending $400, this is worth it. But boy, it's a lot of trouble to go through to make sure you got real shoes.
If you're spending $400, you don't want to buy a replica pair. You want to buy the real pair.
Totally.
And so that's the value proposition that's been really helping us succeed.
Are you a tech company? I mean, it's a mobile app, right? And it's technology-based. Are you a tech company or a shoe company?
Yeah,
what are you?
We are a tech company. I mean, I'm a computer science major. My co-founder is a designer. And we really wanted to inject technology into this experience. So we're even building machine learning models. Since every pair of sneakers that comes in, we're taking pictures of it, we're documenting so that our machine learning models can get better and better at identifying and assisting our authenticators in terms of identifying fakes.
Have you heard from Jeff Bezos and Amazon or Tony Hsieh at Zappos, also owned by Amazon, by the way?
We are, you know, very fond of them. Unfortunately, we have not. They have not called us yet, but my phone is ready when they do.
Eddie Liu, the company is called GOAT. Eddie, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which the president of the United States learns the perils of planning a story on the stock markets too early in the day. And I'll tell you what, I do feel his pain. On his way out to Utah today, before the opening bell had even rung, Mr. Trump stopped by the waiting television cameras at the White House.
The stock market, I think, is going to have a very big day based on the massive tax cuts that we're very much in the process of getting approved.
Dow up 0.2% today, as I said, but the blue chips gave up a 350-point gain on the way there. So as I said, always consult your own financial advisor, all right? Big ups and then some downs on Wall Street today. The Dow up 0.2%. The Nasdaq down 72 points, about 1%. S&P 500 off 2 points, about 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Haley Hirschman, and Daisy Palacios. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.